officials to work towards a ceasefire. What's your sense?
Before my sense, you cannot imagine how the people here in Gaza are approaching such details. And unfortunately, they have been disappointed many times because of not reaching such a ceasefire. We are aiming that this time it could happen because the people are really exhausted. We are really exhausted and we become unable to bear the situations longer. And there is a life that is counted on a daily basis and lost. So all the people here in Gaza are aiming and willing and also looking for the time of such a ceasefire could be announced so they can at least to finally begin to breathe again, to recover and to rebuild and to have this entry complete. And the people even looking for this permanent ceasefire nowadays and not just a pause, because they are looking for a complete ceasefire where they can get all the supplies in and they can, as I said, they can at least recover and breathe again.
Mahmoud, I want to thank you for being with us. Mahmoud Al-Saka is Oxfam's Emergency Food Security and Livelihoods Lead, speaking to us from Gaza City. Next up, we go to journalist Afif Nasuli, just back from reporting in Gaza for 7 weeks while he volunteered as an aid worker for a medical nonprofit and reported in his off hours documenting how many community kitchens have no more food. Stay with us.
And now I see the wind blowing from northwest, and I hear those honkers again. Yonder stepped in that old light walking wolf.
Wild Geeses by the late folk singer Michael Hurley, performing in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
The BBC, Associated Press, Reuters, and Agence France-Presse have called on Israel to allow journalists in and out of Gaza. In a statement, the news outlet said, quote, "We're desperately concerned for our journalists in Gaza who are increasingly unable to feed themselves and their families." Well, our next guest who joins us in our New York studio was reporting in Gaza for 7 weeks during his off hours as he also volunteered as an aid worker for the medical nonprofit GLIA, which brings doctors, nurses, and others into Gaza to support local healthcare workers.
Afif Nasuli is a journalist and host of With Afif Nasuli. He's reported from the occupied Palestinian territory since 2011. His most recent piece for The Intercept is headlined, "Our reporter got into Gaza. He witnessed a famine of Israel's making," which he wrote with journalist and author Stephen Thrasher. We last spoke to Afif in January about their report headlined "Surviving War and HIV, Queer, HIV Positive, and Running Out of Medication at Gaza." Welcome back to Democracy Now! In June, when you left, you were in Deir al-Balah, which was packed with many thousands of displaced people. Can you talk about what you saw in Gaza and talk especially about the community kitchens and hunger, starvation, people starving to death?
Yeah, first of all, thank you so much for having me again. I went to Gaza because of that first report. And I was there from March 27th to June 3rd. I even lost about 10 pounds to 12 pounds. Because we were having one meal a day, there was rice, there was lentils, and sometimes we would have an errant can of tuna that we had brought and hadn't passed out yet to people that were starving. hunger is something that I don't think any of us here can actually fathom. I think maybe many of us can in the United States, but most of us can't. And that feeling was seeing people begging all of the time, no matter where you're walking. If you have, you know, your NGO sort of paraphernalia on, people want to know if you have tahin, flour. And I speak Arabic, and my colleagues were mostly Ghazawi, and we would just really appeal to them and say, we really don't have flour, actually. We're also really hungry. Many of us would just have one meal a day. Now I'm speaking to my colleagues who are having one meal every 3 days, often. I worked at
And you're talking about more than a month ago.
Yeah, this is more than a month ago. The blockade started March 2nd. I got in March 27th. By then, almost, people were already rationing food. We were really, really overly thinking about what was available and what would suddenly go away if we did too much, if we ate too much. I also volunteered at Shabib Ghazza, which is a community kitchen. It's sort of in collaboration with GLIA, so a lot of us kind of do both. And at the start of this genocide, there were about 170 community kitchens. 250,000 meals per day were being served. About 45% of the population was being served. By the time I was leaving, Shabib Ghazza, at least, went from 250,000 meals a day to 25,000. And now they're not operating really at all. I think that they're operating when they can, when some farmer or someone has potatoes. The last time I was there on June 1st, they had a bunch of potatoes, and they were passing them out and preparing them. But that's what they had. They had potatoes. So it has been an incredibly awful experience to see people sort of become sicker and sicker from hunger. I even had an experience where I was sick because I just sort of had beets one day, and I don't know, maybe I had some virus, and together I couldn't sort of hack it, and I became quite sick for about 2 or 3 days. So it's pervasive. If you're a patient, you need protein to heal. I mean, so if you have an explosive injury, and any injury that isn't about malnutrition, malnutrition makes it way worse. And people now are going to the hospital because they're malnourished. People are fainting regularly. I'm getting voice notes all the time from people who are just in hunger pain, which is hard to hear.
And explain the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, so many people being killed while they're trying to access aid. What's going on there? Were you in the vicinity of any of those aid sites while you were there?
Yeah, so they were announced on May 19th. On May 26th or 27th, I believe it was the 26th, was the first aid distribution. It was a disaster. I remember Al-Qarara and Khan Yunis were really loud that day. The GHF has been basically the new sort of brainchild of the Israelis and the Americans. They kind of fight over who even created the idea. But ultimately, there were 400 aid sites around Gaza by the UN-backed system, and it's been replaced by now just 4. For a while, it was 3. And many of them don't always operate. Sometimes it's security reasons. Sometimes it's maintenance. They have a Facebook page people check. From my reporting and my experience, people are shot at. Very regularly shot at. Doctors mentioned that the bullet holes seem targeted, like snipers, because they're in certain spots in the back of the head. There's people who are just simply trying to find food for their families, and they go in the middle of the night to start lining up. And this is for parcels that are about $1.30 in all, like medical supplies, you know, a food parcel, but all of it together is just $1.30. And the experience, from what I understand and what I experienced there, but it's also been more developed since I've left, is that there's thousands of people just disorganizedly just hoping to find something. And when you get something, it's also pitting you against all of your neighbors, all of your family, because you're the one who somehow picked up this bag of flour, and now you have to somehow justify that everyone around you doesn't get to have that flour, just you. So a lot of people are getting into, you know, sort of tension and fights with each other. So it's just an incredibly chaotic, awful, basically supplantation of what was there before, which was working, albeit had its own flaws. It was working.
And you went in as a medical worker. You went in with a medical aid group.
Yes.
And then wrote about your experience.
Yeah, so I went in with GLIA. I think that it's really important to realize that right now Palestinian journalists are suffering because of malnourishment. But for the last year and a half, 2 years, they've been on the front lines. I don't think that they necessarily needed me to go in as a journalist. What they needed was someone to help on the ground, which is what I did. And as part of GLEE, I also documented, did a lot of interviews with doctors and nurses and sort of glean this information in retrospect and have a lot of sources there still. And we'll hopefully go back.
Afif Nazouli, I want to thank you for being with us just recently back from Gaza. We'll link to your piece in The Intercept. Coming up next, countries have a legal duty to limit emissions and high emitters may be liable for reparations, the ruling of the International Court of Justice. We'll go to the Minister of Climate Change from the Pacific Island nation of Vanuatu that brought the case to the court. Stay with us.
That kills its competitors for food. And when they're gone, he kills the competitors of its food too. I'm talking about the birds, the aphids, the insects, and the trees. 'Cause there's innumerable extinct species among these. We've been enacting the story for 12,000 years. The one that says that man must follow no natural law. The one that says that man is distinctly separate from every living thing. That man is the end result of evolution.
The Taker Story by Chicano Batman, performing in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
On Wednesday, the highest court of the United Nations, the International Court of Justice, also known as the World Court, released a historic ruling on climate change. In a unanimous decision from a panel of 15 judges, the court says high-emitting countries do have legal obligations under international law to lower emissions, and that failing to do so could pave the way for reparations from the most impacted countries. This is the president of the court, Yuji Iwasawa.
The court notes that the consequences of climate change are severe and far-reaching. They affect both natural ecosystems and human populations. These consequences underscore the urgent and existential threat posed by climate change.
The ruling is non-binding, but does carry legal and political weight. This comes at the same time as the largest historical emitter, the United States, is unwinding efforts to curb climate change. As we reported in headlines today, the Trump administration is currently moving to strip the EPA of its ability to regulate greenhouse gases. The years-long path to this legal victory in the ICJ began with students. In 2019, a group of law students at the University of the South Pacific sent a letter to the foreign minister of the island nation of Vanuatu. The students said they wanted to bring the question of climate justice to the ICJ, and would Vanuatu help? The answer was yes. This is Vishal Prasad with the Pacific Island Students Fighting for Climate Justice, speaking on Wednesday after the decision.
For small island states, communities in the Pacific, and for young people and for future generations, this opinion is a lifeline. And an opportunity to protect all that we hold dear and all that we love. This ruling is also a testament to the resolve of people everywhere. Those at the front lines who chose not to allow the decisions of a minority of countries to dictate the future of the global majority. Instead, this advisory opinion today provides us a foundation to build a better, sustainable, and more equitable future for all of us.
The Vanuatu official who answered the students' call back in 2019 is Ralph Friggenvanu. He is now the Minister of Climate Change for Vanuatu and has led the effort to bring the case to the High Court, the International Court of Justice, joining us today from The Hague. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Minister. It is quite amazing what you've accomplished. Talk about the significance of the ICJ ruling.
Well, thank you for having me on the program. The ICJ advisory opinion is significant because, as of yesterday, countries can no longer argue that their nationally determined contributions under the UNFCCC, which is the way we ratchet up ambition or action on climate change, are purely voluntary. And that's been the argument we've been facing as small island states at the COPs, going against these high-emitting states who have pledged that they will reduce their greenhouse gas emissions, which are causing the climate harm we're experiencing. But then we see very little action taken, and the argument always is, well, it's a voluntary action that we need to take. Well, that excuse has been eliminated as of yesterday, because the ICJ said, no, it's actually a legally binding obligation under international law, and if you don't do it, it's an international wrongful act that there are consequences for breaching. And so this will help us a lot in our arguments, especially at the next COP we're moving towards. We will be able to go straight to the table and say, well, you can't talk about it being voluntary anymore. Now you've got to really show. And the ICJ advisory opinion also said, you have to ratchet up ambition. You have to cease harmful activity. You have to make pledges that you will not repeat harmful activity. And you also have to restitute those countries and communities that have been most badly affected by climate change, loss and damage they've experienced, or they've experienced having to move away from their homes. These are things which, under international law, there are legal consequences and legal obligations, and there's a duty to repair harm done.
And Vanuatu, Minister Regan Vanuatu is considered the country most vulnerable to extreme weather globally. You've said that you were actually surprised by the decision, the fact that it was unanimous. If you could elaborate on what you think, first of all, tell us what the impact has been of climate change on Vanuatu, and what surprised you about this decision?
Well, in Vanuatu, we're seeing, like everywhere in the world, increasing frequency and intensity of these extreme weather events, particularly in Vanuatu, it's tropical cyclones. We're seeing, you know, Category 5 now just consistently, which is the highest possible category you can have of a cyclone. I think the World Meteorological Organization is now having to create new categories because they're getting so intense. We're seeing that. We're seeing sea level rise. We're seeing slow onset effects like increasing intrusion of salt water into the freshwater lens, which is so critical to life on islands. We're seeing large areas being made uninhabitable. We're seeing real loss and damage, like graveyards, cemeteries being washed into the sea all over the Pacific, people having to move away from where they've always lived for generations. And these are, you know, this is suffering that's happening as a result of climate change. And as the science has shown, this climate change is being caused by greenhouse gas emissions coming from the high-emitting states on the other side of the world. So countries in the Pacific, communities in the Pacific, are suffering from something which they did not cause, and it's being caused by other countries. It's been caused by private actors that are being regulated by states in the West. And this is something the advisory opinion made very clear, that if countries like the US provide licenses and give subsidies to fossil fuel companies, which are private actors within their jurisdiction, this is an internationally wrongful act, and they need to cease doing it. So what I was surprised about, I didn't expect a unanimous opinion. You know, the ICJ is always dealing with contentious cases, and usually there's not a unanimous opinion. There's some judges taking one side and some taking the other side. In this case, there's 15 judges from all over the world. There's a judge from the US, there's a judge from Australia, there's a judge from Morocco, you know, Japan, a wide range of countries from all over the world. But for all of them, unanimously, and they stressed unanimously, to agree that there are the highest level of legal obligations for states, that there are breaches that give rise to causes for reparations. This was above and beyond what we were expecting. But the fact that it's unanimous makes it such a strong opinion, which can be used in all courts all over the world, and it can be used in negotiations like COP, which we are about to go into.
And so, Minister, you mentioned the potential impact of this opinion in the United States. Of course, Trump has withdrawn from the Paris Agreement, an agreement which incidentally does not even mention fossil fuels. When he was asked about the decision, when his administration was, a White House spokesperson told the BBC, quote, "As always, President Trump and the entire administration is committed to putting America first and prioritizing the interests of everyday Americans." So your response to that, and whether you think it will be national courts within the U.S. that will take the most action on climate change as a result of this ruling?
So this opinion from the ICJ was requested by the United Nations General Assembly. The request was unanimous. All countries agreed to this request being made, including the US, which is a member of the United Nations. And the ruling, the advisory opinion that was handed down, said international law creates these obligations for states, not just the Paris Agreement, not just the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. Member states of these are bound by these, but all states, regardless of whether they're a member of the Paris Agreement or not, are subject to international law, which the ICJ has just defined as creating these legal obligations for states to reduce harm to the environment, to stop greenhouse gas emissions that are causing climate change. My response to Trump's statement, or the Trump administration's statement that we want to put America first, this is how we put America first. You see the climate disasters that are happening all over the world, and now I understand extreme heat in the US. We have seen the last 10 years, for the first time in history, the last 10 years are each the hottest year ever. And last year, 2024, was the hottest year ever. And we are seeing, for example, in Washington, D.C., a record number of weather warnings, flood warnings. We're seeing what just happened in Texas. I mean, the American people are being affected by climate change, and more they will be subject to these disasters that we are already experiencing on the front line in the Pacific Islands. So it is in the best interests of the American people to make sure that their government stops this cause of global heating, which is the fossil fuel industry. Science has shown us that, and starts this transition, which America is well on the way to, towards a renewable energy basis, move away from fossil fuels, and start to invest in a secure future for the people of America. Because the more we go down this fossil fuel pathway, the worse global heating will get, and the more disaster will be visited upon the people of the U.S.
We've been speaking with Rao Frigenvanu, Minister of Climate Change from the Pacific Island nation of Vanuatu, that led the diplomatic effort to bring this case to the International Court of Justice. We want to thank you, Minister, for being with us, speaking to us from The Hague. As we continue on this issue, this is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
When the UN General Assembly called on the International Court of Justice in 2023 to provide an advisory legal opinion on climate change, they asked the court to address two questions. What are countries' obligations under international law to protect the climate? And what are the legal consequences for failing to do so? This is ICJ President Judge Iwasawa speaking Wednesday.
The breach by a state of any obligations identified in response to question A constitute an internationally wrongful act entailing the responsibility of that state. The responsible state is under a continuing duty to perform the obligation breached. The legal consequences resulting from the commission of an internationally wrongful act may include the obligations of A, cessation of the wrongful actions or omissions if they are continuing, B, providing assurances and guarantees of non-repetition of wrongful actions or omissions if circumstances so require, and C, full reparation to injured states in the form of restitution, compensation, and satisfaction, provided that the general conditions of the state of the law of state responsibility are met.
We're staying at The Hague. For more, we're joined by Sebastian Dyke. a senior attorney with the Center for International Environmental Law, known as Ciel, which means sky, which supported several countries and their arguments before the International Court of Justice. Thank you, Sebastian, for being with us. This is the biggest case that the UN's highest judicial body, the International Court of Justice, has ever heard, with 100 nations giving oral arguments last December. Can you talk about the significance of the 133-page ruling, a case brought by young people supported by the Pacific Island nation of Vanuatu, hardest hit by climate change?
Absolutely. Thank you so much for paying close attention to this case. I think the significance we can find really first in the validation that actually even just a group of young people with a very clear commitment to justice and bold ideas can actually achieve major change that will actually have very significant impact in global climate policy. So I think the recognition of the fact that the leadership of a few can help inspire such a tremendous achievement, I think, is something that we can all draw inspiration from, and we should draw hope from. And then you mentioned also the historic level of participation by states in these proceedings, and I think it really demonstrates the fact that actually all of the major states recognized the legitimacy, the credibility, the authority of the International Court of Justice in delivering this ruling. Even states like the United States, Saudi Arabia, other major emitters actually decided to come and participate in those proceedings to try to shape the understanding of the judges in relation to the questions posed to them. So I think this really shows that every state is aware of the fact that this judgment will have very clear consequences in terms of future climate policy.
If you could talk about where this ruling will apply, is it only to countries who recognize the ICJ's jurisdiction? Neither the U.S., which is the highest historical emitter, nor China, which is the highest present emitter, recognize a compulsory jurisdiction of the International Court of Justice. So what effects will it have in these two very significant countries?
Yeah, that's a very good question. But the question of compulsory jurisdiction of the ICJ is really relates to whether any other state can bring a claim against this, the two states, for instance, that you have mentioned. So that's a very technical question. But it doesn't mean that the two states, like United States, China, for instance, haven't recognized the authority of the court when it comes to interpreting international law. So yes, the legal avenues to bring claims against China, against the United States, might be more limited as compared to bringing legal claims against other states that have recognized this compulsory jurisdiction, but it does not mean that the law doesn't apply to these countries. And so when we think also of the power that this judgment will have in the context of bilateral relations or diplomatic negotiations, it will definitely also affect the standing of the legal and political arguments of China or the United States. The law that was interpreted yesterday is universal law that applies to all other countries. And again, this is validated by the fact that even China, the United States, actually came, had three opportunities to try to influence the thinking of the judges. And as we have seen yesterday, to a large extent, actually, the judges were quite explicit in rebuking some of the arguments that those major polluters led forward in order to evade accountability.
Well, Sebastian, finally, you have 30 seconds. The role of national courts. The BBC said lawyers could start bringing cases as early as next week in national courts.
Absolutely, this will embolden the plaintiffs, victims of climate harms, but also hopefully judges in being more responsive to the need to apply existing law in the context of climate change. What we really need is to end an era of impunity and just actually rely on existing legal principle to hold polluters accountable, whether they are corporates or governmental. So tomorrow we expect, or like from today, starting today, we expect a new era of climate accountability.
Sebastian Dyck, I want to thank you so much for being with us, senior attorney with the Center for International Environmental Law, known as Ciel, which supported countries and their arguments before the International Court of Justice. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Arc Sustainability Society is an independent, student-centered nonprofit working across SFU campuses. Embark focuses on climate and food justice in their programs and initiatives. Some of their ongoing work includes their food rescue program, learning gardens, and sustainability career nights. Discover your role in building a sustainable future based on your unique skills and interests. Learn more at embarksustainability.org and follow along on Instagram at embarksustain.